sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
There are so many meetings that are status meetings, check-in meetings, you know, meetings about the meeting, meetings to plan the meeting. We just don't need any of that, right? So what's the agenda? What's the meeting type, right? Is it an inform? Is it a decide? Is it a discuss? What's the meeting purpose? What are we trying to achieve? What's the time commitment required, not just in the meeting, but for the project overall? What's the rock or metric that it ties to? Who are the attendees and what are their roles? So those are some of the things we want to make sure are defined as part of our meeting charter for every single meeting we have. And I think just putting the requirement in place to define those things will automatically reduce the meeting load, right?
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Mark Rosenthal. Mark is the Chief Operating Officer at HQO. It's a commercial real estate technology company. And in our conversation today, we have a wide-ranging talk about Mark's own journey into sales and sales management. And we dig into the critical milestones in his own development that have propelled him forward in his career. Mark was formerly the CRO at HQO, and we dive into the topic of what support that CROs need from management, from their own team, that perhaps they're not getting. And how is this reflected in the high churn rate of sales leaders? Then we explore what changed for Mark's sales team during the pandemic. And he talks about the lessons that he learned, and then shares how he has updated his organization in response to all of this. Before we get to Mark, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could leave us a review, give us your feedback about how we're doing. So thank you very much. All right, let's jump into it. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. You're joining us from where?
I'm joining from Boston, Massachusetts, from our corporate headquarters. Yeah.
Worldwide headquarters.
Corporate headquarters. Yep.
So, tell us about HQO and what you do.
Sure. So HQO is a commercial real estate technology platform. We help connect people to their workplaces to better use their spaces, take advantage of the services and amenities, and then provide the employers or the landlords with lots of data about how those spaces are being used, employee sentiment, and really better understanding about the value of the workplace experience they're creating, the likelihood of employee churn or turnover, and the better strategies and data to make CapEx and OpEx decisions. So I'm the chief operating officer here at the company, but I spent a long time coming up through a sales track, and that's what I've done for most of my career, all of my career. And here at HQO as COO, in addition to running sort of the day-to-day operations of the company, I oversee all of our commercial teams, so marketing, sales, customer success, et cetera.
So commercial real estate's kind of fraught right now. I was just listening to something last week that caught my attention, that it's like a $12 trillion asset class in the United States. And, you know, people are projecting that, yeah, maybe on a permanent basis, a good quarter of it's just never going to be needed or not needed anytime soon. So how's that impacting your business?
So commercial real estate, you're right, is a huge asset class. It's the largest or second largest institutional asset class in the world, multi-trillions of dollars. So there's a lot of interest in understanding what the future of the asset class is and for our world, what the future of the office is. A lot of our landlords and our tenant companies who we talk to and work with are really interested in figuring out the strategies that are going to help return employees to the office. Obviously, they have financial interest in that, as if you own buildings. But for companies, they're focused
on people in them. Yes,
buildings are only valuable if there are people in them, right? Right. So landlords obviously have incentive to bring people back and to partner with their tenant companies in new and different ways than they've ever had to before. It's not enough to just provide the four walls and the floor. You really have to provide an offering, a service, an experience that makes coming into the office, sitting in all that traffic and dealing with the hassles of commuting and leaving the house and taking a shower in the morning and putting on real pants, right? Worthwhile. Those are trade-offs that people will have to make. And after almost 2 years of this pandemic, people have built some pretty consistent habits, and breaking habits, as we all know, is pretty hard to do. We think that landlords can help tenant companies to help their employees to do that. We think that tenant companies or employers have a great opportunity through technology to create a more unified workplace experience. And when we think about the workplace, we think about the workplace broadly, right? The workplace today is defined as anywhere you work. It could be the home, it could be the office, it could be the Starbucks or anywhere else. And we want to empower the workplace experience, right? Empower the employer and the employee no matter where they're working.
Yeah, it's just that we're in the situation where it seems like their employees have sort of the upper hand, if you will, in the face of the pandemic and the quote unquote great resignation, or as someone called it, the great reassessment. That it's, yes, you read about a lot of CEOs talking about, people will all return to the office. And well, it's been a moving target, right? Because of Delta and other functions. But
right.
Are your people, the people, your customers saying that they have a degree of confidence that, what people seem to be fairly firmly attached to, sort of the hybrid model, is, they'll be able to bring people back despite the attachment to that model? Or what are you sort of sensing? And I know it's, not an expert, but you talked to a lot of people in that field.
Sure. My sense is that they certainly have a lot of hope. If some of them do have a lot of confidence. I also have a lot of confidence that people are going to go back to the office. I mean, we've been back in our office with our whole team for several months. Most of us came back. Many of us came back over a year ago. So we were out for the first 4 or 5 months, and then started a slow return to office. And we did a lot in terms of the carrot initially. So what are the incentives? What are the amenities? What are the things that we can do from an experience standpoint to really win our employees back to the office of their own volition? And then eventually we got to the stick where we said, we're drawing a line in the sand. This is the date to come back. And we expect everybody to be back in the office, at least in some capacity. And what we found was we got a little over half of the employees back with the carrot. And then when we had to use the stick, just about everybody else came back. We lost two employees through the process, only two. And our company is about 200 people. So, 1% of the workforce, lost due to our desire to have everybody back in the office. We have a flexible policy. It's the same policy we had pre-COVID, though, which is 1 day a week, work from anywhere. And that's what we tell our employees. And what's been really interesting since people have come back, I had a conversation with one of our engineers one morning about, maybe two or three weeks after we all came back to the office. And he was like one of the last holdouts, one of the last guys to come back. And I saw him in the lobby of the building, and we were coming up the elevator. And I said, how's it been being back over the last few weeks? And he said, it's been awesome. He said, I was just in this habit of sort of like, waking up in the morning and rolling out of bed in my pajamas and going down to my computer and just cranking and doing my, you know, doing my work and, you know, being in my, you know, being in my downstairs office. And I forgot what it was like to come and be with the rest of the team and to, you know, have that, energy. And it's just so awesome to be able to be back in the office with everybody. And then he told me about how he was moving and that was going to change his routine again. And, you know, he was trying to figure out his commute and all the stuff. He's, you know, again, is like one of the last holdouts to come back. He's in the office. We have a, as I said, a 1 day a week work from anywhere policy. He's in the office every single day. So I think really we have to figure out how to just create the habit of coming to the office anew again, because routines are routines. People don't like change and it's hard to break that. But I think there are a lot of benefits and we can talk about all of them as we go here.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, so why was it important for you guys as a management team to say, we need people here? Cause this is, you know, if you spend any time on the, you know, the whatever you want to call it on LinkedIn, where, you know, no shortage of opinions, you know, there's a lot of people fairly dogmatic about, hey, if you're an employer going to require people to come back to the office, you know, a large swath of people just aren't going to come back.
Yep.
And so your experience wasn't that, as you talked about, but why did you think it was important?
We thought it was important for a few reasons. So number one, you know, we're a commercial real estate technology company, and the product that we sell, at least, you know, the product that we make and sell, at least at that point, was really focused and still is really focused on workplace. And workplace, our definition of workplace, you know, 6 to 12 months ago was really the office, right? And we felt like it was important to drink our own champagne and that we had to be in the office. And I remember sitting on calls with customers early in COVID from the office, and them telling me that they were talking to all of our competitors and that we were the only ones who were actually in the office. And they were in their offices too, as real estate folks. And I said, well, it's really hard to build technology for the office if you're not there. And and one of the customers said to me, yeah, it's really hard to lease space if you're not in the space experiencing it. And I said, yeah, exactly. Right. So number one was that, you know, it's the business that we're in, and we felt it was important to drink our own champagne or eat our own. We like drink our own champagne instead of eat our own dog food.
More positive than eating your own dog food. I was going to say,
That's right. Our head of engineering uses that one. So number two is we're a growth stage company. And so as we've gone through this growth spurt over the last couple of years, building relationships with the people you work with is really important for a few reasons. Number one, trust, and number two, empathy are most important. And what we saw as we hired more people and as everybody sort of retrenched to their homes in early COVID was an erosion of trust. And some of that is just due to the fact that the company is getting bigger, right? And you don't have the same level of trust, empathy, and connection to employees in a 200-person company or a 500-person company. I worked at Google, right? 100,000-person company than you do at a 20-person company. But also, personal connections build trust and empathy. And so we saw these silos start to erect between departments, finger pointing and blame game stuff, and felt like if we could get people back together and rebuilding those relationships and trust and empathy, that would help us to break down some of those silos and be more effective and productive as a company. So that's number two. And then number three is because we're onboarding so many new people and trying to ramp folks up, particularly on the sales side, our ability to coach and develop our team really diminished during COVID. And we had to be really deliberate about putting systems in place and processes in place to do that much more deliberately than we did when we were all, you know, in the office together or traveling together, right? So we have a feedback system here. It's really simple. After every meeting, we do a one up, one down. What's one thing that went well? What's one thing that could have gone better? And we do it around the horn for everybody in the meeting. And typically, we do that walking out of the meeting. So when we go see, if we're going on a sales call and we go see a customer, we walk out of the customer's office and we do a quick one up, one down. And then maybe that night, if we're on a, if we're traveling together, we go to dinner and we do a much deeper breakdown of the day and the meetings we had and what we could have done, you know, what we could have done better, how we can improve next time, what our action items are. In this virtual world, we're all going Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom. And it's really hard to carve off the time to do those one-ups and one-downs, to give the coaching and the feedback to our teams. And so what we saw was a slowdown in ramp time for our employees. And so we felt like getting people back in person and that learning through osmosis, that feedback loop of the one up, one down, those opportunities to coach and, you know, to ride sidecar with your reps were just irreplaceable in a, you know, in a Zoom environment. And we've seen, and we've seen the results from it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about it because it's, yeah, a lot of people think that it's the way that we've been doing it the last couple of years works just fine. And I think what we're going to find is, at least my opinion, is that perhaps as they get more experiences like you're experiencing, is that you then begin to see the contrast of where perhaps it wasn't as good as you thought it was.
Right.
There's no question you could get business done, right? I mean, you got business done. Lots of companies get business done. I mean, for years, you've been able to do business virtually. That's what the telephone is for and so on. But yeah, I just wonder whether people overestimate the degree to which things have worked virtually and remotely.
You know, we did an exercise at our last senior leadership team meeting, which I'd done a couple times before with other teams. It was a picture of Charlie Brown, like a big, you know, picture of Charlie Brown. I cut it up into little, you know, sort of post-it size pieces, and six pieces, right? Broke everybody up into teams and asked them to duplicate their picture on a big poster size piece of paper, right? So everybody had, you think about it like a puzzle, everybody had one of six pieces of the Charlie Brown puzzle. They 10x the size of their picture, and then they had to go put the puzzle together, and they had at the end a Picasso looking Charlie Brown, right? And the point of the exercise was everybody individually did a great job with their, you know, with their blowing up of their picture. But when they put all the pieces together, it didn't all fit, because it's really hard to drive alignment across a team when you're not all connecting and talking and working as a team to understand the bigger picture, right? So that's, you know, I just think there are so many benefits to in-person work. And look, it doesn't have, I'm not saying it's going to go back to the way it was 5 days a week, everybody's in the office and that's it. But I do think there are a lot of benefits to being in office, and a lot of benefits to teams, you know, working together, collaborating and spending time building relationships that can't be replicated over Zoom in the same way. And I believe that the companies that are out in front of that trend are going to be the big winners down the road, right? I mean, from a sales standpoint, I'd rather be the guy flying to San Diego or New York or wherever to take my customers out to lunch or dinner and talk about their business and whatever, than get the call that my customer was just being wined and dined by my competitor and they're going to make a move, right? So if we have competitors.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think that the willingness to go meet face to face, even though there's this plethora of studies saying, yeah, buyers no longer want to meet, you know, sellers, blah 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 blah. It's like, no, your willingness to go be face to face will become a differentiator here fairly quickly.
Yep, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
And especially for us, especially in the commercial real estate industry, it's very relationship driven still. And that stuff matters. It doesn't matter to the same degree in every industry, but for us, it matters a lot.
So how did you travel from Google to HQO?
By car. It's a short drive. No. Right. I had the chance to meet Chase Garbarino, who's our CEO and co-founder, maybe in 2010, I think, and didn't know him particularly well, but just knew him from around the market. He had he had a company called Bostino at the time. It was a digital media publishing platform that put out content about the startup community and what was happening in the startup community. The company was acquired by American City Business Journals and the Newhouse Families, or parent company to like BBJ and Reddit and Condé Nast and lots of other great, great publications. But Chase was pretty well known around the market, and I had the chance to meet him, and we got to know each other, you know, very, very loosely over the subsequent, you know, 8 or 9 years. I'd get together with him for a cup of coffee every other year, and we kind of ran into each other in the airport one day in early 2018, and said, "Oh, hey, it's been a couple of years. Let's grab a cup of coffee and catch up." And he told me what he was up to at HQO, and I thought there was a really interesting opportunity here with the business, because here's an industry in commercial real estate that has really no connection or understanding of the end user of the product, the people who are in and out of the buildings every day, how they use the buildings, who they are, what they like, what they don't like, what kind of value they're creating through the capital investments they're making or the operational investments they're making in the space, the retail that they're bringing in. And they had no data either. So what the problem that Chase was trying to solve, as he articulated it, was helping landlords to better understand how their spaces are being used to make more informed CapEx and OpEx decisions, and to do that through technology and data. And having spent all this time at Google, one of the things that I worked on while I was there was programmatic advertising, which was all about using technology and data to create efficiency and intelligence in a system that previously hadn't had a lot of it, right? Buying media was a relationship, was a relationship business. It was spreadsheets and it was, you know, dinners and all of that. And then along comes programmatic advertising that makes targeting better, that makes buying faster and more efficient, that drove up the performance for advertisers and down their costs, right? And I thought that was just such a great win for the ecosystem overall. And we could apply the same principles to commercial real estate. And I got really intrigued by that problem as a business. And so the opportunity to go and build that from the ground up was super exciting. So I joined in November of 2018. I was the 14th employee. And we've been off to the races ever since.
And so you joined as CRO.
I joined as VP of sales and customer success. And then I took over marketing and moved into the CRO role. And then just this past July moved into the COO role.
So your first CRO role, what was, you know, when you got into it, was there like moment it was like, was there something I didn't know that, you know, sort of surprised you about the job, or some support that you thought you needed that you weren't getting? I mean, how'd you manage sort of your own development into that function?
Yeah, it was and remains, or I had and continue to have like a major case of imposter syndrome. I wasn't sure what the job was. I wasn't sure how to do it or how to be successful at it. I wasn't sure why I was asked to do it or be successful, or how to be successful at it. I had never run marketing as a function ever before in my career. I'd been fortunate that I sat across from marketers, you know, since I worked in the advertising and media industry. I'd sat across from marketers for my entire career. That's who we sold to. So I at least had some basic understanding of marketing, but I'd never run marketing as a function. You know, I was a career sales guy. I had some touch on account management, but not really on customer success. So I just kind of went to school and started reading and trying to learn as much as I could about how to be a CRO. I talked to some other CROs that I know. I joined what was then the Revenue Collective and is now Pavilion, which is a great community for sales, you know, for sales professionals, and now a much broader community for business professionals in lots of different functions. That's been a key resource for me in learning and development. I tapped my network and my mentors and asked for a lot of help. And then most importantly, I hired people who are better than I am at all of their functions.
that's been a great strategy. That's been the biggest help. You mentioned mentors, because something that I talk about on the show quite a bit is salespeople in general, sales professionals aren't cultivating mentors. You know, they sort of expect coaches to sort of be that, or their managers, frontline managers, to be that. And I just interested, you know, who's been your mentor, and were they, you know, somebody that you worked for at one point, or, you know, someone that you met some other situation that's somebody you can call on?
Yeah. So I talk to my teams and to other folks when I'm talking career development about establishing your personal board of directors, right? So the way that I sort of frame career conversations is that, you know, you're the CEO of Andy Paul Industries, right? I'm the CEO of Mark Rosenthal Enterprises. Like, nobody cares more about my career than I do. Nobody cares more about yours than you do. So, absolutely. You know, you have to operate that way. And part of being a great CEO is finding the right board of directors to advise you. And so I've been really lucky, I think, in my career to have worked for some great people who I call on, and to have met some phenomenal leaders who I call on for help and advice. You know, whether it's learning about a new role or assessing a new opportunity, a new career opportunity, like coming to HQO. One of the guys that I call, I don't call him that often because he's super busy, but I do call him for big important stuff, is Mark Roberge, who I think you know. I think
I know everybody, Mark, yeah.
Everybody in the sales world seems to know Mark these days, after his massive success at HubSpot and now at Stage 2. But Mark, I met Mark back in 2007 or 8, like really early HubSpot days. Right. And Mark did me the biggest, I did myself the worst favor in declining an offer to join HubSpot as like the second or third salesperson. But Mark did me the biggest favor, probably the biggest favor of my career, in about 6 or 12 months after we met, he put together a group of sales leaders from around the Boston area, folks that he had met along his journey that he thought were, you know, smart sales leaders that he had learned from, and put together a quarterly, he called it the Sales Executive Roundtable. And we'd get together once a quarter for dinner, and he structured the conversation. Everybody came with a nagging business problem. It was a great way to you know, get to know each other and to solve problems together. And I met some phenomenal people that way. I met a guy named Brian Schmidt, who was running the Boston office for Google. That's how I wound up making the move over to Google eventually. A guy named Jim Norton, who went on to be the chief revenue officer at AOL, and then through the acquisitions, all of that whole journey through Verizon Media. Ryan Burke, who was at Compete, which was acquired by Millward Brown, and then he went to Envision App, and now he's the CRO at a company called Catalog. So all these guys who met when we were sort of, you know, at that director VP level, you know, we've all stayed in touch, you know, either close touch or loose touch. But those are some of the folks that I call on from a mentorship standpoint. Those are some of the folks that I look to for advice and guidance. And then I've had some great bosses that I look to as well. My two great bosses from my time at Google that I call frequently for help and guidance. And my very first boss my entire career, a guy named David Strauss, who had a long run at Living Social for the up and the down, is another guy that I call on a lot. And so I've got a great board of directors.
I think it's a great concept. I think it's a great concept for people to, they're listening to the show, to implement is, yeah, who can you talk to? Because it's not always going to be your boss. Oftentimes it's not going to be, for a variety of reasons. But you need to have those people in your lives, in your career? And I mean, most of mine have been people I'd worked for that just had a different relationship with that once we went our own separate ways, just been invaluable in terms of, to your point, advice at critical moments when you need it.
Yeah. Yep. Who's your best mentor?
Well, it's a guy I worked for back in the day, a long time ago, and was the most rigorously demanding person that I had ever worked for. Way smarter than me in so many ways. And what we bonded because he was willing to learn, and he taught me how to sell really large accounts, which mm-hmm. I'd never done before. And, I just remember he'd call me on Sunday afternoons and just want to talk about accounts and what I was working on. And it started to really concern me that, wow, he knows more about what's going on in my accounts than I do. And part of it was just intuition and experience. Mm-hmm. But, I sort of thought, yeah, he's probably unhappy that I wasn't seeing enough progress. And he was picking up the phone and calling these people. Yep. And so I learned a very valuable lesson at a very early age. Just like, that's never going to happen again. Yeah. I'm never going to, my boss is never going to know more about what's going on in my accounts than I do. But I just operate with such high level intellectual rigor that it was just a great role model. Just learning how to operate with intention every step of the sales process, that there is no such thing as an unimportant sales touch. And what are you doing to help the buyer make progress in their journey? That's because that's our focus, right? It's not about selling a product. It's about helping them make a decision. So he's been somebody I could talk to for a long time. So those people are valuable. And you just talked about your first bosses. I just had my first boss, literally my first boss ever in my career from over four decades ago, on the show just last year. We'd sort of reconnect on LinkedIn and he was able to tell all sorts of embarrassing stories about me.
That's right.
Out making those initial cold calls. those were the days, let me tell you. One of the things we want to touch on is when we'd communicated before the show was that you've sort of rethought your organization sort of in response to the pandemic and how things get done. So what have you done differently? Or are you doing differently?
What are we doing differently since COVID?
Yeah.
Now we're back to a lot of what we were doing pre-COVID because we've got so many people back in the office and we're operating pretty similarly to the way we were before. I think the biggest changes that we've implemented are less a factor of or less driven by COVID and more driven by the growth of the company. Mm-hmm. Just as we scale. So, some of the things that we're doing are aligning, realigning resources internally. We've invested in some great training for the teams to get everybody aligned on the same story. We worked with Force Management. Mm-hmm. They're a great group, and they helped us with our messaging and our sales process, and we're rolling that out across the entire team. From a product standpoint, we've made some adjustments to what and how we're selling, the markets that we're going after, and really tried to drive more focus around what we think is our core purpose and our long-term goal and strategy, and align the entire company to that. We've introduced things like a company operating cadence that's visible mm-hmm. to everybody in the company, so everybody knows when everything is happening. When are we doing sales kickoff? When are we doing department QBRs? When are we doing our senior leadership team meetings every quarter? When's the exec team going offsite for the quarterly strategy retreat? Mm-hmm. When are our engineering sprints, right? All of that is shared across the company. So maximum transparency, which helps to drive alignment and accountability as well. We've introduced a regular quarterly senior leadership team meeting which we weren't doing previously. So we get our entire senior leadership team together in person once a quarter to make sure that the strategy is cascading throughout the organization, that the entire senior leadership team is aligned and on the same page, so that as they go back to their individual teams and departments and groups, they're able to execute knowing what the North Star is that they're that we're all trying to achieve. So those are a handful of things that we've introduced. Yeah. We're also working on some other more tactical things, but that are really important, whether COVID related or not. Things like a meeting charter. So you know, if you're going to have mm-hmm. a meeting, I talked earlier about how it's like Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom to Zoom, right. Or in person meetings, same thing. We're all back to back. It's pretty crazy, and I'd like to reduce the meeting load for the company. Number one, and number two, make sure that the meetings we're having are really focused, and that the people who are there all have a critical role and need to be there. Like one of my biggest pet peeves, and I know it's for a lot of people, is for me personally, is being in a meeting that I don't have a role in or don't need to be at, and for meetings that I am in where I have right. a role, right. seeing other people who don't have one checking their email or just kind of tuned right. out. It's like, well, why are you here? Why do we even invite you? And it's not on them. That's on the meeting owner, right? So putting together a meeting right. charter to define like the meeting goal and the agenda, the purpose, the attendees, all of that kind of stuff. So it's just one small yeah. example.
Well, I was talking to somebody yesterday about a similar topic, and they were saying that as part of their meeting charter is, there are no hour meetings. There's 45-minute meetings. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make sure they're building in space before and after the meeting for specifically the purpose you talked about before, so that you can have the casual conversations that, especially if you're in person, that don't happen over Zoom when everybody just terminates the call. But, the pre-meeting, the post-meeting, the casual post-meeting, so that, as you said, the plus one and the minus one, or up one and down one. Yeah.
And making sure that that's all called out in the meeting agenda, along with mm-hmm. what is the, what's the specific company rock or objective that this meeting is related to? Because if the yeah. meeting isn't related to one of our big company objectives, we shouldn't have it.
Exactly. Right?
We do so many, there are so many meetings that are, status meetings, check-in meetings, meetings about the meeting, meetings to plan the meeting. Right. We just don't need any of that. Right. So what's the agenda? What's the meeting type? Right. Is it an inform? Is it a decide? Is it a discuss? What's the meeting purpose? What are we trying to achieve? What's the time commitment required? Not just in the meeting, but for the project overall. What's the rock or metric that it ties to? Who are the attendees and what are their roles? So those are some of the things that we want to make sure defined as part of our meeting charter for every single meeting we have. And I think just putting the requirement in place to define those things will automatically reduce the meeting load, right?
Well, it certainly make them more effective. And I mean, they're really things that you should be doing for a sales meeting, right? With a customer.
Right. That's right.
You have the same requirements. So last question for you is, and I got this question yesterday from somebody on LinkedIn. I thought, okay, well, I'm talking to Mark. This would be a good guy to bring it up with. Someone more toward the beginning of their career, sort of in the first AE role. He said, look, I want to be a CRO. What should I be doing? What should I be doing to put myself in a position over time to be able to have that role? So what advice would you give somebody who's sort of earlier in their career that, wants to aspire to be a VP of sales or CRO? What's the path they should define for themselves?
Okay. So a couple of things. One, get yourself a personal board of directors.
Right.
which we already talked about, right?
Yep.
Two, hit your numbers. Three, put your head down and just do the work, right? Mm-hmm. Don't get so far out. Like the thing that I hear a lot, particularly from entry level or junior folks, is I want to be a CRO and I want to be a CRO in 3 years. Like, why don't you close your first deal and then let's talk about your next deal. And then mm-hmm. after you hit quota consistently for a little bit, maybe we can talk about a manager role, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's have a I guess the other would be have a realistic view of the time horizon and the path and understand all of the things that you need to learn and do to become a CRO. And then last piece is read, be a learner, read right. a lot.
So what would you recommend for somebody just getting started, best things to read and start learning?
Sure. So I think if you're just getting started as a seller, read The Challenger Sale. It's a great book. As you're getting into sales management, read Mark Roberge's Sales Acceleration Formula mm-hmm. and understand how to start building teams and building a sales organization. And then as you're thinking about becoming a CRO, read books about leadership, read books about company building. Books like Good to Great, which is a mm-hmm. a never-ending classic. Extreme Ownership is another great one. Blitzscaling by Reid Hoffman mm-hmm. are some good ones. I just finished reading The Ride of a Lifetime, which is Bob Iger's book about his journey, to Disney CEO. And I thought it was an outstanding read. I mean, there's so much content out there. I keep a very long reading list for things that I want to get to. Some of the things that are on my reading list now that I haven't started yet, but my reading list right now is The One Thing, The Ideal Team Player, The Leadership Advantage, The Talent Code, Principles, which I just started by Ray Dalio, The Speed of Trust, I Can See You Naked, yep. The Speed of Trust, great book?
Oh, yeah, great book.
Okay, good. I look forward to reading. Another great one for folks who want to be a sales leader is The Qualified Sales Leader by John McMahon. Yep. I think that's like Mark's book. That's a great one in terms of sales qualification methodology, approach, how to run a deal cycle, how to run a forecast meeting, and then you don't just read it; you got to absorb it, right? Read it, right. Learn it, live it. That's the advice.
Well, it's the value of books, right? I was having a discussion with somebody just this week. It's like, yeah, there's lots of great short content out there, but the best learning and studies of buttress this. The best learning comes from long form content.
Right. And then you have to apply it, right? Yep. And you have to test it and see what the biggest struggle that I had, actually one of the biggest struggles I had early in my career is I was reading a lot of these books and, some of them say the same thing in different ways and mm-hmm. some of them say different things. And so figuring out amongst all of this great sort of content and advice, what I can make my own, right? What's my flavor? My style of all of this stuff? So you got to read it and then you got to test it and see what works for you and what can be authentic and adopt those things and forget the rest and move on and keep reading and keep learning and keep growing and developing.
That's right. Keep experimenting. Excellent. All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great. It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate it, Andy.
Yeah.
This was fun.
Look forward to talking again.
Yeah. Ditto.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Mark Rosenthal, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thank you for your help with that. And as always, thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations. And after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.